to listen to. All right. Well, thank you for being here. And I wanted to start by lowering your expectations a little bit. It says prescription for healthy neighborhoods. That might be a little bit strong terminology. So what I'm going to talk a little bit about tonight is some implications from the Code Red report are that we should be focusing more on place-based approaches to policy and to address some of the issues that that Code Red highlighted. And so that's really the framework I'm going to be talking from. And it's going to be fairly high level. And I'll use a couple examples from elsewhere in the world, but talk a little bit about the pros and cons of that kind of an approach to policy. I want to start by saying that, wow, what an incredible response. I'm really quite stunned. I want to really thank people for being here and just congratulate Steve Buist and Pat DeLuca, who are both here, and their team that includes Neil Johnson on the report that was published on Code Red back in 2010. Clearly, it's a brand that has a lot of endurance and a lot of cachet for people. So, I think it's another example here tonight that just the amount of engagement that that report has stimulated in the community. So, you know, I think that if nothing else, we're really far ahead on that. I'll put that in my pocket. I'm going to begin tonight talking a little bit about the relationship between income and health, when this works. Oh my gosh. There we go. Okay, oops, went too far. So my work is really focused. Oh my gosh. What you saw on the previous slide, this is going to be a source of humor all night. I know. Okay, wait. Maybe the batteries are dead. Oh, how could you tell that? Excellent, super. So my work focuses on what you see here. If you want to push, it'll be the down. I believe that's okay. Down. Yeah. So thanks. Why don't you get a chair? So my work focuses on this relationship, which shows the relationship between income and health in this case. So what we have is we've got income groups on this on the horizontal line, and we've got health status on the, in fact, ill health status on the. On the vertical lines. And basically what it shows is the greater your income, the better your health status. The interesting thing about it, though, is that it affects everybody. It's something that transcends the entire social spectrum. So even at the highest income groups, we've got better health in the highest income groups compared to the next highest, compared to the next highest, all the way down. So this is something that affects all of us in society. And the thing that is fascinating about it, and it was reflected in Code Red, is that, in fact, this relationship, it wouldn't matter if I changed income groups to educational attainment or your position in a job hierarchy or any other kind of measure of social status, you'd see the exact same relationship. On the health side, this is something that is not specific to any specific disease. Most of health and medicine is actually very disease specific, right? We have cancer prevention strategies and we have diabetes prevention initiatives and so forth. The fact is that this relationship between social status and health status is something that is not disease specific. It's something that's going around that really expresses itself through different diseases. So really this, what we call the social gradient in health, can be seen for everything from accidents, injuries, suicides, poisonings, most cancers, heart disease, stroke, mental health, infectious diseases, and so forth. And it's something that's been enduring for well over a century. There were these kinds of inequalities existed back to as long as they've been keeping records in the United Kingdom and other countries. These kinds of relationships were seen. So it's a really, really powerful relationship. And it's something that we're not quite sure what it is, right? It's not about money, because you can't rub money on your skin and eat it, and it doesn't have any health benefits if you do those sorts of things, right? What is it? It creates control. It creates a sense of worth. It creates a whole host of other self-confidence, self-efficacy, and so forth in people's everyday lives, and just different living conditions. And that's what ultimately translates into different health. And so that's an important part of the backdrop here. You want to give it a whirl? Thanks, Jen. Perfect. Thank you. So I've talked for the moment, just a second ago, I talked about health inequalities. But the proper term I should be using is health inequities. And the difference between inequality and inequity is an important one. Inequity implies something about unfairness. Inequality just talks about a difference. And inequity says that that difference is, in fact, unfair. So health inequities are, in fact, caused by social inequality. And there are differences in people's health that are unnecessary, avoidable, unfair, and unjust. And I really want to concentrate on the avoidability, because oftentimes people talk about these things as if, you know, there's nothing that we can do about this. You know, it's just something we have to accept and so forth. And it's actually completely untrue. The relationship that I showed you a moment ago, showing the relationship between social status and health status, in different societies, it's steeper than in other societies. So in places like Sweden and other Scandinavian countries, the income differences in health status are actually quite small. In countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, the differences by class and income are actually quite big. So it really depends on the kinds of social policies that countries have, and even at the lower levels that different governmental and other kinds of organizations have, and the economic structure and so forth. But ultimately, we're talking about something that's modifiable and that's ultimately avoidable. So health inequalities are avoidable. Thanks. If you could give it a whirl, Jen. Thanks. It seems to be more reliable. So the other thing is that good health is a basic right. And it's a right that really can't be separated from other kinds of rights, like the right to housing, the right to access to a good standard of living, a good education, freedom from discrimination, ultimately participation in society, full participation in society. And that's one of the things that we're really concerned about. Thanks, Jen. So let's focus a little bit on poverty. When we say poverty, what do we mean? Well, this is one definition of poverty, and it says that poverty, people in living in poverty, if their income and resources, and that includes their material resources, so the, you know, the actual things that they have control over, their cultural and social resources are so inadequate as to preclude them from having a standard of living which is regarded as acceptable by society generally. So it's really about inclusion, in fact. As a result of inadequate income and resources, people may be excluded and marginalized from participating in activities which are considered the norm for other people in society. So the notion of social inclusion, which is a big component of the Hamilton Community Foundation's mission and a number of other organizations, is actually quite important, and poverty intersects with it really strongly. So why is poverty problematic today? How did we get to this stage? I'm going to just show you a couple of trends in the way in which income has been distributed over the last several years. This shows the percent change in taxable income adjusted for inflation over the past, between 1982 and 2004. And essentially what you've got are different income groups along the horizontal axis here. And essentially I think of those as rungs on a ladder. So there's a ladder in society, and in some societies the rungs between the ladders have bigger gaps. And what this basically shows is that over time the gaps between the rungs in society have grown bigger. And in fact they've gotten a lot higher for upper income groups, but they've mostly stayed the same for middle and lower income groups. And what that basically says is that over the past 20, 25 years, lower and middle income groups have actually, their wages have been stagnating or staying constant, and at the same time that people have been working more, whereas the top 10 and even 5% have done wildly well. So what we've seen is this incredible concentration of income and wealth in the upper reaches of our society. So it's not so much that people are doing more poorly in the rest of society, it's actually that the really ultra-rich are doing much, much better. And that has consequences for everybody. If you can just skip the next one, it shows more or less the same thing with respect to wealth. So let's focus a little bit on Hamilton and the kinds of patterns that were shown in Code Red. So Code Red showed that there were a number of disparities in Hamilton. I should hasten to add, I had nothing to do with the production of Code Red. And I'm just fortunate to be here at a time when there's so much community engagement around this, because I do work in this area and I'm very interested in it. Let me say, though, that they're very large. And basically it shows that poverty is spatially concentrated. And we know that people with low incomes tend to live in the least expensive and least desirable housing, wherever that may be. And it's really a kind of a function of the way that markets work. And so this has important consequences for anything that you do to address concentrated neighborhood poverty, because the side effects of addressing concentrated neighborhood poverty may actually displace people and force people to other locations that might not even be as good as the ones they were in. So we're going to talk. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. Often, in addition to being low income, these things come with low education, poor skills, poor health, and other kinds of statuses that that marginalize people and make them disempowered in society and excluded, really. It creates significant concentrations, ultimately, of marginalized people in neighborhoods. So why would we care about this? Why is there so much response to, you know, the Code Red report and being here tonight? Yes, thanks, Jen. Well, these are the patterns that you see. This is the directly from the Code Red report, and it shows the patterns that we all are aware of, and it's the overall ranking based on a cumulative score for 20 social, economic, and health variables, and it shows the neighborhoods that we're concerned with in the lower city primarily. Thanks, Jen. We can go forward. Well, why should we care about this? Well, there's a number of big policy initiatives and platforms that are, I think, important for caring about this. One comes from the OECD, which is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is essentially a large multinational organization that is a consortium of the many of the developed countries. They have a Territorial Development Policy Committee, and they've raised a lot of concerns that in their member states, large concentrations of poverty and wealth alongside each other in urban areas is actually inhibits economic growth. Now, it's kind of an unfortunate motivation to be concerned about concentrations of poverty, frankly, that it's inhibiting economic growth. But some groups of society, it's the only way they can get to a concern. And frankly, I'm willing to accept their concern regardless of their motivation for it. So they're basically saying that it impacts on growth and investment, and they've done a number of studies in large cities around the OECD, including Toronto, where they've identified these kinds of patterns. Concentrated poverty is also a concern because it results in what social scientists have called deprivation amplification. And what this essentially means is that it's one thing to be poor, but it's yet another thing and additionally disadvantageous to be poor in a poor neighborhood. Because in addition, so we've got a lot of evidence, particularly for its impact on healthy child development, for example, that low-income kids who grew up in homogeneously poor neighborhoods are worse off than low-income kids who grew up in more mixed-income neighborhoods. And the reasons for that are believed to be that there are better resources available to them, different kinds of exposure to different kinds of career and life paths, as well as connections in terms of networks to power and influence in the world, and those kinds of things. And for adults, similar kinds of things. There's more resources, and better kinds of connections to the outside world, and basically more social inclusion, ultimately. So these effects can also be self-perpetuating over generations. So we see these kinds of patterns passed on over generations. And another way of thinking about this is to thinking about a neighborhood as operating as a local opportunity structure. So essentially, the kinds of, to give you a simple example, if one of the things that you're supposed to do to maintain your health is you're supposed to engage in physical activity. Well, in lots of cities, including this one, there are systematic differences in the resources that people have available to engage in physical activity. Right, recreational spaces and access to those things, recreational facilities, clean, safe, well-lit streets, and so forth. And there's lots of studies that have demonstrated that the resources that people have available to them are differentially distributed, so that lower-income neighborhoods essentially have fewer resources to help people stay healthy compared to more affluent ones. And this is really important because so much of the messaging that we get in the mainstream media is that it's really all about willpower, right? Oh, well, you just have to change your behavior, and so on and so forth, right? It's not about willpower, actually. It's the environment, the opportunity structure is essentially structure people's environment, the behavior in particular kinds of way. A good example actually comes from smoking. I had a friend when I was a student, and he did his PhD research on smoking cessation. So he was doing focus groups with a number of people who were smokers, and he introduced the focus groups by saying, well, the statistics show that about 22% of Canadians smoke. At the time, that was the number. And the people who the smokers that he was talking to said, whoa, 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 that can't be the right number. It's got to be much higher than that. It's probably, that number's probably fabricated as a conspiracy to try and get us to quit smoking. And the fact is, though, in their world, probably more than 22% of people do smoke. In my world, in the day-to-day life that I live, a very small proportion of people smoke. So in a sense, there are norms about, in different segments of society, some of them created by neighborhoods, that dictate certain kinds of behaviors, and they become, if you like, normal, if one way or another. And those strongly influence people's behavior and well-being more generally. So we can go to the next. Thanks, Jim. So, one of the questions, of course, that this community is facing is place-based policy a solution to this? And I'll start by giving you the punchline. It's not a magic bullet, but it is something that we can do at the local level. And there are things that we can do at the local level. In fact, place-based policy has actually been quite popular over the last 15 to 20 years in a number of countries, including the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and now Canada. So Canada's kind of a late adopter, and while on the one hand we might say that's not such a good thing, it has a really important upside, which is that we can learn from other people's mistakes. And so that's a good upside. The most active place, I think, in place-based policy, in fact, has been in the United Kingdom. They've been doing it for over 20 years and really quite aggressively. And it's led to a whole host of different initiatives that they call area-based initiatives. So it's kind of a class of policy initiatives that they've undertaken. Some good examples include the New Deal for Communities, which is a large national initiative to reduce inequalities in a whole host of indicators that I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail in a moment. And another one was Health Action Zones. They now have a new one that they're rolling out in London called the Healthy Towns Program. And so suffice it to say that, you know, there's quite a large number of these for us to draw some learning from. Ultimately, this involves targeting defined areas for additional investment and programs in order to reduce inequalities between those areas and the average or, you know, just other areas generally. There are some Canadian examples. There's a national program called Action for Neighborhood Change that was piloted in three communities across the country that the United Way of Greater Toronto and the City of Toronto adopted in its priority neighborhood strategy. There's also been the priority neighborhood strategy itself. And then you could also say that there are these things called urban development agreements that have been initiated in Vancouver and Winnipeg. In fact, the Winnipeg one has been in place for a very long time. And they too represent place-based strategies. Our next speaker in the speaker series that we're starting today is Dr. Neil Bradford, and he's a political scientist who specializes in the policy aspects of place-based policy, the political aspects of it. So he knows urban development agreements inside out and backwards. So we're looking forward to that. This kind of place-based policy has been recommended by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development Cities report that they did on Toronto, and also the McMurtry report on youth violence that was produced a couple of years ago after all the shootings that took place in Toronto. Justice McMurtry issued this report, and a huge part of it was on place-based policy to provide job and recreational and educational opportunities for youth in Toronto neighborhoods where there was concentrated urban poverty. And so this kind of thinking is certainly prevalent in Canada already, and it's really a question of how do we best use it to address the issues that are facing Hamilton. So let's talk a little bit about the principles under place-based policy, because it's important to think about these, because this, I think, is where it becomes very clear that it's not a magic bullet, and that there are things that it can do, and there are limitations to it, and that we should be acutely aware of both of those things. The first is that we know that identifiable geographical areas have high levels of social problems. And one of the things that's believed, and one of the reasons why it's believed that place-based policies that are more designed to local circumstances might work better, is because they can be customized to those local areas and mainstream programs, right, that are kind of delivered for what they say in Quebec, Monsieur et Madame tout le monde, right, which is, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Everyone. Anything that's designed for the sort of generic person isn't always going to work in all places, and that you might be able to do more customized programming in a place-based kind of way. So that's one of the logics behind it. We know that individual disadvantage is worsened by area disadvantage. So this is something that we want to address. It magnifies problems. And it's really important for both social and political reasons to address the disparities between areas. And your presence here, I think, underscores the social importance of it and is, in fact, going to carry a long way to reinforcing the political importance of it as well. Another way of thinking about it is that at some level, concentrated social problems in neighborhood areas represent people who are hard to reach, if you like, with mainstream programs. It's actually hard to get people engaged. It's hard people get, you know, for example, most programs, if you like, with respect to, say, parenting programs, it actually requires people to become aware of the program, to identify it as something that they might want to participate in, to find all the resources that are needed to get there, transportation, maybe care for another child, you know, time off work, you know, all those kinds of things, and then actually get there and participate. So there's a number of obstacles to getting there. So reach is a really big problem. And often it's in mainstream programs, it's not well thought out exactly how we're going to reach all of the people who are in the greatest need. So one of the implications is that place-based policy may reach a greater number of people who are in need because of its sort of custom design to the local circumstances and its focus exactly on those places. Okay, so going a little further on the rationale for place-based policy, area or place-targeted programs have an advantage often in that they tend to be a little bit more bottom-up. So one of the ways that one of the things that they've learned in the United Kingdom is that the best way to do place-based policy is not for the British government and Whitehall to say, okay, these are going to be the programs, and we give you the resources at the local authority level, and you deliver these programs. Actually, what they tend to do is they give the local authorities resources, and they say, all right, you go and talk to people in your community, make partnerships with social service organizations, charitable organizations, and so forth, and come up with a plan for what it is, how it is you're going to use these resources in a way that's going to meet the needs of your local community, because you're in the best place to essentially identify what those needs are, and you're in the best place to figure out exactly how those needs can best be met. So it's very much, well, on the one hand, the resources come from top down, the content of what the programs are going to be and the way in which it's going to be delivered and governed is much more bottom-up. And in that sense, it has big advantages in terms of its ability to customize to the local population. And that's quite unlike the mainstream programs, because the mainstream programs tend to be very centralized, and it's, you know, somebody in an office in a government building many miles away deciding this is going to be the nature of the program, and people are going to love it. Not always. Now, municipalities and local communities more generally, but certainly, but I'm thinking in specific about local governments, municipal governments, they are somewhat limited in their ability to address all of the things that affect poverty. They do have policy levers that can affect the spatial pattern of poverty, but they can't really affect poverty per se, right? The municipal government does not set social assistance rates. The municipal government does not set the rules for unemployment insurance, or employment as insurance as it's ironically called now. The municipal government does not make decisions and doesn't seem to have much influence over the federal and provincial government's investments in social housing, for example. A whole host of things that affect people's well-being and affect poverty are not controlled by municipal governments, right? Municipal governments do have some policy levers available to them, but those are not them. So it's important, and this is exactly what I was saying earlier, it's important to realize the limitations and the possibilities from this and really focus on the things that can be done at a local level and not despair about the other ones, but you know, work hard on provincial and federal governments on to address those kinds of things. And one of the outgrowths of working hard on those local things, rather than saying, oh, we can't do anything because the provincial government won't raise social assistance rates or any of those sorts of things, those local programs can lead to increased capacity to participate in the community, increased confidence and capacity, community development. Right? There are huge impacts that can come from that. And then ultimately, successful area-based programs may act as a guide to changing the way that mainstream programs are delivered. So if you do something in a couple of communities really successfully, and you figure, well, there might be a way actually to do exactly the same thing on a much wider basis. If we could persuade the provincial government to deliver social assistance differently, for example, or ODSP differently, based on our experience here, then that would be another incredibly positive benefit to come out of a place-based policy. Thank you, Jen. Now, let me say that there is a rationale against place-based policy. And it's important to be aware of this as well. Again, going to the point that this is not a magic bullet. The fact is that, as they say it in the UK, most deprived people don't live in deprived areas. So essentially, most people who live in poverty don't live in neighborhoods that are highly concentrated with poverty. And the consequence of that, or the upshot of that, is that place-based policy could be seen as unfair to low-income and poor people who live in non-concentrated neighborhoods. And if you could go to the next slide, please, I'll show you exactly what I'm referring to. So this is just the pattern of poverty in the city of Hamilton. And it shows us the familiar pattern where we see high percentages of poverty in the lower city, in the east of downtown sort of area, and lower percentages in the outlying areas and South Mountain and South Stony Creek Mountain. And if we could go to the next slide. But what I'm going to show you on the next slide is a map, and it's the exact same pattern I just showed you, although we've zoomed in a little bit. It's the exact same pattern of poverty rates in the background. But superimposed on it is the number of people in poverty in each of those neighborhoods. And what you see is that in the lower city, the areas that were highlighted specifically in code red, we have high rates of poverty and large numbers of people in poverty. But there are other neighborhoods where the rates are lower, but the number of people is almost as high. And so essentially the argument is that against place-based policy is to say that those people who live in neighborhoods with a low percentage of poverty but high numbers are disadvantaged by this kind of policy. And there's a counter argument to that that I'll get to in a moment, but ultimately it's worth knowing this risk. Yes. Another argument is that place-based policies only disperse or dilute problems. It doesn't actually solve them. So, of course, the obvious thing about to deal with place-based poverty and concentrated poverty is to change the concentration. So how would you change the concentration? Well, one possible way is you could find ways to attract more affluent people to move into low-poverty neighborhoods. And that may displace some people. And there's lots of ways that that can take place. One of them is through conversion of buildings that are multi-unit into single-family dwellings. So there's lots of buildings around that at one time were single-family dwellings. They've been split into multiple units. That's actually market housing, but it's quite affordable. Well, what tends to happen in gentrifying areas is more affluent households come and they like these big houses and they want to live in the whole house. And so they take what was previously three units, eliminate the separations between them, and make it into one big house that they're going to live in the future. Well, that's a net loss of three affordable units. And when that happens multiple times over many different buildings, then you have a huge net loss potentially of affordable housing, and it effectively displaces lots of people who otherwise would have lived there in affordable housing units in those places. Another way that it happens is that as that's happening, rents generally go up. And now rents can't go up when you're living in an apartment because they're rent controlled. But as soon as a tenant leaves an apartment, then all bets are off, right? The landlord can raise the rent as much as they want. And so that can, that might happen rather innocently where people just happen to say, well, I'm going to move somewhere else, and they go and move somewhere else. But it can also happen in a lot less innocently where they start to get subtle harassment from landlords in order to try and encourage them to leave, right? So they might let the building get dilapidated. They might be unresponsive to complaints and to repair requests and so forth, and that might just lead people to go, I'm fed up with this place, I'm moving out, and that plays right into the landlord's hand because they get to raise the rents higher. So that leads to a loss of an affordable unit as well. So there's lots of different ways that can happen. So that's dispersing, or that's also related to dispersing, but also diluting. So the other idea is that basically it doesn't change anything about overall poverty rates in the city; it just dilutes it. Now, to some extent, that's probably the least disconcerting of the things that it can do, because the concentrated neighborhood poverty becomes less of a problem because there are more resources available. It might invite economic activity and jobs and other kinds of opportunities. Another argument is that place-based policies may reduce the urgency to address problems at other levels. So some people may say, and I've heard this said in lots of places, that, you know, listen, we're at the local level, we're really limited in the things that we can do. And if we do too much, then the senior levels of government, who really need to come in on this at the provincial or federal level, they're not going to do anything. They're going to say, oh, well, these, you know, the local community has it handled just fine. And so the argument then becomes, well, we don't want to do too much and overstretch ourselves as a result of this, because if the problems get, you know, essentially, if we relieve some of the problems, then there'll be no justification for the provincial government, and the urgency won't be there for the provincial or federal government to come in. And so that's a valid argument, but you know what? What I'm seeing is that the provincial and federal government aren't really coming in anyways. So you know what? Honestly, I don't see, you know, I mean, I know that there's a provincial poverty strategy and so forth, but it seems to have been upstaged by the recession and a variety of other issues. But anyways, the long and short of it is that there's another argument, I think, that's maybe even a little more compelling. And that is, we're going to do everything we can at the local level. We're going to pull all the policy levers that we have available to us. And we're going to say, hey, provincial government, look at what we're doing in this area. We're making a big difference, but we could make much more of a difference if we had your participation in this particular way. This is the kind of help we need. And so I think that that's a far more compelling argument. And given the tradition of paternalistic relationships between provincial governments and municipal governments, where essentially the provincial government says, you know, well, geez, if we let the municipalities spend and spend and spend, we always have to bail them out. And, you know, there's all these kinds of politics that go on between those two levels. It seems to me that that's probably the more compelling. And then it has other benefits, right? Because, it will be possible to make a difference, and it will have big impacts at the local level. And then, of course, I've kind of alluded to this already, increased affluence in these kinds of neighborhoods can displace low-income households through gentrification. And I think that in this case, this is a very real danger. So I look at an area like the north end of Hamilton, particularly in the area around where the GO station is going to be for all-day GO service. When all-day GO service comes, it is going to attract many, many households who otherwise would have lived closer to Toronto to live there. Because most of the houses that are in the north end and just east of the north end, the built form itself is exactly the same as the houses that are in the most popular areas of Toronto. Cabbage Town, the Annex, all those sorts of things, right? It's the exact same house. So if you're thinking about this as from the perspective of a Toronto commuter, somebody who commutes downtown Toronto, you're going to say, okay, I can live in Toronto an hour and 10 minutes by transit from downtown Toronto, and I can pay $600,000 to $800,000 for a 3-bedroom house, or I can buy the exact same house in Hamilton, the exact same transit distance from downtown Toronto, for a third, a quarter of the price, put a whole bunch of money into it, make it into a palace, and be way better ahead. And that will happen time after time after time. And so the consequence of that it will drive up the local housing market. It will displace people from affordable housing units in the market. And it's very predictable. It's been seen in a very, very clear way in a very quick process in the Parkdale neighborhood in Toronto. And so my prediction is that in about 5 to 7 years, assuming that GO comes on reasonable schedule in terms of all-day service, that the north end will be completely different from what we know it now. And as a consequence, it's going to have big implications. So the side effects, if you like, the unintended side effects, are going to be potentially pretty damaging. So what's the how to avoid that? Well, the way to avoid that is to build affordable housing. So essentially, try to estimate the number of units that are likely to be lost through that kind of a process and replace them with other kinds of affordable housing. So they could be affordable home ownership. There's a number of really innovative initiatives like Options for Homes, for example, that can be used to do affordable home ownership. And the thing that creates a window of opportunity right now is that in the north end of Hamilton, land is very cheap. in the big scheme of things from a GTA perspective. Incredibly cheap. The thing is, it's not going to be cheap forever. So the window of opportunity to do something is actually relatively limited. And the longer time goes on, it's going to narrow. And you know, the employment report that came out about the improvements in the core just the other day, I think, is testament to the fact that that pattern's already moving, at least at a relatively slow, maybe at a relatively slow pace. But it could quicken quite a lot once the announcement of Go comes. So it's a really, these are important issues, and I'm going to touch on that a little bit more in a moment. So let me give you a little example from the UK. Yes, we can just, thank you. Those are breather slides. So, not for you though, yes, that's right. Sorry, Jen. Thank you. So I mentioned earlier there was a large initiative done in the UK called the New Deal for Communities. And it was done at a slightly different scale. It was a nationwide initiative, and the communities that they're talking about are relatively big areas, but the principles are pretty much the same, and I think that they're actually pretty sound ones that they had there. So this was launched in 1998 to reduce the gap between deprived communities and the national average on a number of different theme areas that I'm going to talk to you about in a minute. And the thing that's really important about it is that it was a sizable commitment to this. They spent, in the first 6 years, they spent over £1.5 billion across 39 communities. So it was a sizable investment of a significant amount of money. So, and I think that underscores the fact that this can fly politically, and it can succeed politically, and that there is a social imperative to do this that can essentially defeat any kinds of objections that people might have. So it actually was a 10-year initiative, but in the first 6 years, that's how much they spent. And it addressed six theme areas that are the same kinds of theme areas that we see in our community. Poor job prospects, high crime, educational underachievement, poor health, poor housing, and the physical environment more generally. So those were the things that it specifically targeted. And basically what happened is they provided funds. Each of these communities could apply as a consortium of a number of organizations, could apply for the funding, and they had to set out a plan for how they were going to address these outcomes. And then they were measured against benchmarks from when they started. So we'll talk more about that in a second. So they were community-led partnerships that established priorities and engaged local providers to deliver programs and encourage collaboration. There's a lot of synergies that exist within our community that aren't being, that really aren't being exploited. There's a lot of things that could be, that different organizations could be doing together that would make them a lot more effective. And you know, that takes work, of course. And there's all there's already great things doing being done, but I think that there's a lot of exciting energy, if you like, about doing more and creating more synergies right now. So both place-based and people-based initiatives were undertaken. And by this I mean, by people-based, I mean essentially programs that are delivered to people. So job training programs. They had a large initiative, a national initiative in the UK called Sure Start, which was essentially early child development programs. So those are aimed at individuals, right? And they're essentially saying, okay, here's the neighborhood. This is going to help us identify large groups of people who are in need, and we're going to try and deliver programs to individuals. But they also delivered place-based programs, which was really about neighborhood refurbishment. So essentially making the built environment look good, right? And in this sense, things like good architecture and good design and clean streets and neighborhood beautification, they actually become really important stuff. They're not fluff. It's not just window dressing. It's actually really important to people internalize those kinds of messages and say, you know, this makes us, this is a beautiful neighborhood. We live in a beautiful neighborhood. It makes us worthy, and as well as attracting other kinds of residents as well. So that's really important in terms of those place-based initiatives. The medium results, term results, were that they were able to create changes in place-based outcomes a lot quicker than they were in people-based outcomes. You know, the fact is, in a lot of cases, you're talking about people who have had long trajectories who, throughout their entire lives, perhaps, where they've been marginalized and had all kinds of disadvantages. And so it's, you know, it's difficult for anybody to change at any time in life. So the kinds of things that moved were community image and community reputation. The people-based ones they thought were going to take a bit longer. And this is really important, though, these place-based ones, because these were really important to retaining middle-income households. And what I mean by this is that because of the kind of research and evaluation that they had attached to this project, which was substantial, and I'll talk about it in a little bit more detail in a moment, they were able to tell that what was happening in some of their neighborhoods is they were having young couples buy properties in the neighborhoods that were the areas that were getting extra investment. They were buying these properties when they were sort of early in their relationships. They were kind of surfing the property market as things increased and things improved. And then as soon as they got to the point where they had school-aged kids, they'd cash out and move somewhere else because they were afraid of the consequences of sending their kids to the local schools. And so the conclusion that they drew, which is the right one, from observing this pattern, is that if you're going to do place-based policy, A, you have to be in it for the long haul, and you have to do it aggressively. It has to be potent enough to retain those households, because it's actually more damaging, in a way, to let them go, because they provide a lot of capacity for the community, right? They provide a lot of energy for the community. They provide economic activity, jobs. They keep shops and other kinds of services going. And if they leave, then what do you have at the end of it? You have this, you know, the same kind of capacity you had before, or maybe slightly more, and an inflated property market. So essentially, you've made the problem worse. So this is incredibly important that the interventions on a place-based level need to be potent enough. They suggested that, in fact, this may impact ultimately that if you stick with it, eventually the people-based outcomes will improve later. They did incredibly, in the New Deal for Communities, they did incredibly intensive monitoring of the impacts. They did household surveys every 2 years with the same people. And in addition, they followed people who moved out of the neighborhood over the entire 10 years, and they also replenished in-movers. So they had, in each of the 39 communities, they had a large sample. It was actually a sample of 10,000 households. So they surveyed 10,000 households across these 39 communities, and they followed the people who moved out, and they also added to their sample with new people who moved in. And they followed the same people through time. And that's how they were able to know that, in fact, they had this pattern where young couples were buying properties and moving out before they hit the point where they had school-age kids. And it's critical because it creates an opportunity for course correction. And I'll come to this in a little bit more detail in a moment. But the point is that in a long-term initiative like this, step one and step two, you might have a pretty good idea about. But step 14, you're not going to know what step 14 is until you've seen what happened on steps 1 through 13 in a lot of cases. So as a result, it's actually really important to have good information flow. And I'm not just saying that in a self-serving way because I'm a researcher. Okay, so what factors can municipal policy target to transform neighborhoods? Thank you. So basically, this framework that I'm going to describe to you in a minute comes from some conversations that I had with a number of people around the city, and it came from somebody asking me the question, we need to know what makes great neighborhoods. And I was completely terrified when I was asked this question, because I actually said to myself in a really quick second, I have no idea what makes great neighborhoods. I know what makes lousy neighborhoods, because I've written papers on it, and I've read hundreds of different studies on what makes lousy neighborhoods. And then ultimately, it wasn't actually about what makes lousy neighborhoods or good neighborhoods that we really need to know. We need to know what are the things that you need to target in order to change not so great neighborhoods into great neighborhoods. And so I want to suggest to you that the things are here. The first one is physical capital. And I've used the term capital because these are kind of assets that are available, right? It's basically to reinforce the fact that you're not starting with nothing. And here we're talking about land. I alluded to that a minute ago. Buildings, and I alluded to that a minute ago. Heritage architecture, streets, natural features. Hamilton, for example, has incredible natural amenities. People give it a bad rap, of course, but when you look at Hamilton from the air or even from the escarpment, it's an unbelievably lush place. And those are natural, and the Bayfront restoration and so forth has been all very influential on, you know, essentially enhancing Hamilton's natural amenities and its natural assets. So there's a whole host of assets that it can really play upon in the sort of category of physical capital. Economic capital is an obvious one because, you know, we're talking about poverty, and so essentially we're talking about bringing more commerce and more economic activity to the downtown core and to the lower city. But this includes household disposable incomes, business capital, and then the spin-offs that come from that related to employment and so forth. And I want to suggest to you that there's lots of
interconnections between each of these. Human capital. This basically refers to people. Skills, knowledge, credentials, capacities, health and vitality. And there are two key issues related to human capital that Hamilton has to address. The Code Red report showed that there are significant disparities in things like high school completion rates from one neighborhood to another, right? Huge disparities. And we actually have really quite alarming levels of high school dropouts in some of our neighborhoods. So we have a human capital production problem in the sense that we need to be able to get more kids to finish school, right, to produce that human capital, to go on to post-secondary education. There are lots of great initiatives that are going on related to that. Pathways to Education has now arrived in Hamilton, and that's, I think, going to make a huge difference. The more that can be spread into more neighborhoods, and it'll improve people's connection to post-secondary education and so forth. But this is really important, human capital production. The other one is human capital retention. And one very exciting initiative in Hamilton related to that is the Hamilton Hive, the group of young professionals who've kind of organized themselves. Because what a lot of young professionals are saying in Hamilton is that there's kind of a career ceiling for them. They can sort of move up the ranks in terms of their career and advance their career, but only to a certain point, at which point there are no more senior jobs for them to get. They have to move to Toronto. And that's a loss. And so the more that we can retain those people, and the way that we retain those people, of course, is by creating job opportunities, creating amenities that make them really want to live in Hamilton for the long term, and creating transportation linkages and so forth. The more that we can do those kinds of things and retain human capital, the better it's going to be for everybody. Social capital is the third one. And here we're talking about people's relationships to one another. So there's a term that we use in the social sciences called collective efficacy, which basically has to do with how good people in neighborhoods are at organizing themselves around issues of concern in their community. And we've seen lots of evidence, actually, that with a little bit of support, neighborhoods can actually be very good at organizing themselves. And the McQuest neighborhood, I think, is a shining example, and there are undoubtedly others. And so so there's a lot of examples of that, and I think that the more that initiatives from foundations and from non-governmental organizations and the city government themselves can encourage those kinds of things, the better off we're all going to be. The other thing has to do with trust in neighbors and institutions, and I want to focus a little bit on institutions. One of the challenges, of course, that we have in neighborhoods that are faced with a lot of social problems is that they have lots of interaction with formal institutions like the social service system, the police, the emergency response systems, and so forth. But just from that list, you can hear that most of the interaction with formal institutions is pretty negative. You know, it's not all that positive. It basically reinforces that there are things wrong, there are problems. It might be that they feel harassed. It might be a whole host of things. But the interaction is mainly related to that, and their interaction with the city government is, you know, might also be quite distant. And I know that one of the initiatives that the city has been taking on is about customer service and essentially delivering value in terms of public services. And I think that the more that initiative gets out to people and the more that people have an experience with that, it's going to improve their trust in institutions, if you like, which has a huge impact on people's well-being, and it has a huge impact on people's willingness to engage in the community, to get together, because they think that their efforts will be complemented by efforts by the government, that they will be heard, that their concerns will be heard by the local government. And that's incredibly important, right, to have that kind of trust in institutions. And I think that we're really turning an important corner on that in the community right now. So the last one is around cultural capital. And here we're talking about place identity and image, cultural knowledge, and what are called symbolic goods. And essentially what this comes down to is about neighborhoods having an identity, right? And we've, you know, it's happened in James Street North now. James Street North has become, you know, the new artist haven, and it's got the art crawl going, and it's got a significant influence in that, and it's really developing a very, very cohesive identity, and it's attracting people, right? People really want to be there, right? Art crawl has been wildly successful, and the same sort of thing has happened in other kinds of neighborhood initiatives around basically people identifying with their neighborhood and saying, you know, this is an important group that I belong to, and I'm going to put my energies into this group. And essentially affiliate with it. That hasn't been the case for the longest time, right? We actually have, if you look at a map of the city, there are actually names of neighborhoods that probably many of you have never heard. And so the more that we can actually make those names kind of come alive, right, and people will identify with them, it will become something that draws people together, right? Yeah, we belong to this neighborhood. This is our identity. And people will be in a position to, you know, to say, well, this is what we want our identity to be, and go out and make it that way. And you know, they'll get support from local institutions. And you know, the cultural mapping strategy that the city is doing right now is a really great example of essentially they're inventorying all the cultural assets that we have in the city now, and they can be drawn upon for that. So there's all kinds of connections to this, right? The cultural capital is deeply connected to the economic capital, right? The more that you have identifiable neighborhoods where people can say, yeah, I really belong to this neighborhood, I want to be part of this neighborhood, I identify with it, the more you're going to attract people who are going to support services in those neighborhoods and so forth, right? It's going to cause people to open businesses and so forth. There are connections with human capital, obviously, to all of these things, because people's skills and abilities and capabilities and their hope, essentially, for the future is, I think, also going to be really influential. So this is, I think, gives us a little bit of a framework to work through. Let me talk a little bit about the research component of something like this. So I think one of the things that is a strength of the New Deal for Communities is that it did, and I've explained this to you already, it followed people through time, it followed them at regular intervals, followed the same people, and it followed in movers and out movers. And the other thing is that they compared the communities that received the New Deal for Communities investments to comparison communities. So essentially they were able to show whether the changes in the communities that received those interventions were greater than communities that didn't receive it. And that's really important because it basically shows you that what you were doing was effective. The other really important thing, and I'm just going to sort of get you to focus on the last point here, which is that if you don't have a rigorous evaluation, then there's no way to correct your course, right? You start off doing something, and you actually think you know what steps 1 through 14 should be from the beginning. Unless you have some way of getting feedback on whether steps 1 and 2 worked before you implement 3, then you might implement 3 and there's no call for it, or it does harm. So this is why I really suggest that it's important that we essentially create out of a number of our organizations, including the university and people like me, but in conjunction with the city and non-governmental organizations, essentially a learning community where we learn about ourselves, right? We take on certain kinds of initiatives, we try and get feedback from that, correct our course, and go forward. And the same would be true of even neighborhood associations, right? If there can be more information, and you know, one exciting thing that's happening right now is this new open data initiative that's seems to be gathering some steam in Hamilton. I think could really help fuel that. So I won't talk any more about my potentially self-serving research message. So let me conclude by saying that there's great potential for place-based policy. We should be aware of its limitations. It's not a magic bullet, but nevertheless, it's something that can be done and it can start to create some momentum. It's very well matched to municipal policy leaders. As I said, the municipality has lots of things available to it, right? It has economic development, it has parks and recreation, it has cultural strategies, it has a whole host of different policy levers available to it, things that it can do, that it can marshal its resources with, to do, and that it can partner with other organizations to do, and I think that that's really quite heartening. It requires complementary action from senior governments. So I don't want to suggest that this lets senior governments off the hook. It certainly doesn't. There is, the patterns I showed you at the very beginning are very real. We know that in adjusted for inflation, social assistance rates have gone down over the past 2 decades. So that essentially people are living on less than they were before. And that's at the same time that things like user fees and people's entitlements to services have gone down at the same time. So their actual disposable incomes have actually gone quite a bit down. So there are really important issues for a senior level government to deal with. But hopefully if some achievements can be made at the local level with local, municipal, and local policy levers, that can help to invite other levels of government on board to assist with those sorts of things. As I said, Canada's a late adopter, so we can learn from elsewhere. And we need to be concerned with both the how and the what of place-based policy. Well, by the how, I mean, how are we going to organize it? How is it that we're going to identify communities. How is it that they're going to govern themselves? How is it they're going to have communication channels to major institutions in the city? So all the sort of governance aspects of doing place-based policy. But also, and to be honest with you, there's been an overemphasis on that governance aspect in a lot of things that have been done in Canadian place-based policy because there was very money behind them, right? Basically, they were largely money-free place-based policy. And so they only focused on governance. They only focused on getting communities to talk to one another and get organized. To what end? And so if it also has a significant what, in the sense of, well, what else is going to, what's going to be delivered by means of this relationship between people in communities and between those communities and the local government, then that's a whole other thing, right? That creates a whole level of potency that's otherwise not available. Ultimately, in some neighborhoods, we're really going to need to prepare for success. So I alluded to this already with my description of the North End. There are other places that are like that. There are going to be a lot of predictable negative side effects. Again, we can learn from elsewhere. This has been, you know, these kinds of patterns have occurred elsewhere. These kinds of changes have occurred elsewhere. And there is a window of opportunity to begin to prepare for those negative side effects and try and mitigate them before they happen. And then ultimately, I think that because we need to be able to learn from experience, we need to have the capacity for course correction. We need to think about exactly how it is we track the progress. And, you know, I think the other thing, too, is that the more that you can track progress, the more you can celebrate success. And we don't get into what are the dangers of the reports that we see showing all these negative patterns, is that people can become desperate, right? And they can just despair and say, oh, things are never going to change. Things are so bad. Yet another report showing that things are so bad. Well, if we actually have benchmarks where we can say, hey, we started here and we got to here, let's focus on that and say, you know, well, we can also improve in these areas, rather than just having these one-off reports that come and say, oh, things are really terrible. So that's the end of my remarks. If you could just change to the next slide again, it will tell people where they can get more information. And I invite you all to ask some questions now. Thanks.